It's great having the kids with us. It reminds me, somebody said once, a child is someone who has not yet learned how to manage their face. And I think there's an important truth there, because sometimes when we grow up, maybe all the times we grow up, that's what we do. We learn how to manage our face. We put on our church face. And I love how kids remind us that worship is about bringing who you are, that we sing our hallelujah wherever we're coming from. So we're glad you're here, no matter what brought you here this morning. I appreciate Quinn reading the passage. There's a lot packed into the few verses that he read. There's a king who shepherds his people, a covenant of peace, the picture of God living perfectly among his people. And that's really good stuff, and we're going to get to all of it. But first, we have to talk about sticks. We got to talk about sticks because that's what Ezekiel talks about. He gets to sticks as an object lesson. So let's go back to Ezekiel 37, where Quinn was reading, but let's go back to verse 15. Ezekiel 37, starting in verse 15. The word of the Lord came to me, "Son of man, take a stick of wood and write on it, belonging to Judah and the Israelites associated with him. Then take another stick of wood and write on it, belonging to Joseph, that is to Ephraim, and all the Israelites associated with him. Join them together into one stick so that they will become one in your hand. When your people ask you, 'Won't you tell us what you mean by this?' say to them, 'This is what the sovereign Lord says. I'm going to take the stick of Joseph, which is in Ephraim's hand, and of the Israelite tribes associated with him, and join it to Judah's stick. I will make them into a single stick of wood, and they will become one in my hand. Hold before their eyes the sticks you have written on, and say to them, "This is what the sovereign Lord says. I will take the Israelites out of the nations where they have gone. I will gather them from all around and bring them back into their own land. I will make them one nation in the land, on the mountains of Israel. There will be one king over all of them, and they will never again be two nations or be divided into two kingdoms. They will no longer defile themselves with their idols and vile images or with any of their offenses, for I will save them from all their sinful backsliding, and I will cleanse them. They will be my people, and I will be their God." Ezekiel is saying this, and he's demonstrating this, and it's about the 580s BC, so nearly 600 years before Jesus. And at the time is when many of the Judeans, Ezekiel among them, have been exported. They've been exiled to Babylon. They've been taken away from Jerusalem, and Jerusalem has fallen. It's destroyed. No more king, no more land, no more temple, no more city. It's all gone. And because of that, the people have lost their hope and their identity. And frankly, they're asking the question, who is God, and is he even powerful enough or even around anymore? Because back in the land, they were secure. They thought things were good. In fact, they thought they were much better than their brothers to the north. And so here they are in the southern kingdom of Judah, and they're the remnant. They're the ones who are still going to the temple and worshiping God, at least in form. But their brothers to the north, the other tribes of Israel, have been decimated by Assyria nearly 150 years before that. So they've been long gone. In fact, it's been a really long time since Israel has been one nation under King David. It was about 1,000 years before Jesus, the last time Israel was really together as a people. David was the second king of Israel, but he was the last one to preside over a unified people seeking and trusting God together. They were one, but they united for just, historically, it was like a blink of the eye. And here is the old prophet Zeke showing up and saying, "You will be one again." And to do that, he grabs two sticks. So he has two sticks, and maybe not exactly like this. These came out of my recycling bin this morning. And he holds them up. And if you hold them just right, you can get people to think that maybe, if I hide that little part there, maybe it's one stick, right? And so you hold this up, and the people are kind of confused, as they often are when the prophets do stuff. They don't know what to make of it, because it's usually more strange than two sticks. But he holds them up, and he tells them what this means, that God is going to make one out of two. God is going to bring them together. Now, in this poor illustration, what holds these together is my hand, right? My hand's not very strong. It doesn't do much. It can fool you for a minute, but not very long. But imagine if these sticks are the people of God, and imagine if this hand is the hand of God. Then is there any limit to what the hand of God can bring together and give life to? So Ezekiel demonstrates this to the people of God, and he's basically saying to them, what is impossible, what seems impossible, is possible with God. Because here's the thing about sticks. They come from trees, right? And trees are living. Sticks are dead. But sticks are a part of a tree. And you don't usually go backward, right? You go from a tree to a stick. You don't go from a stick to a tree. But in God's hands, that's exactly what happens. In fact, if we flip forward about 10 chapters to Ezekiel 47, verse 12, as Ezekiel is painting a picture of this new temple, listen to what he says. Fruit trees of all kinds will grow on both banks of the river. Their leaves will not wither, nor will their fruit fall or fail. Every month they will bear fruit because the water from the sanctuary flows to them. Their fruit will serve for food and their leaves for healing. Ezekiel describes this new temple because, of course, the original is gone. The Babylonians have ground it down to dust. But even so, Ezekiel sees a day when a tree will grow, when trees will grow, and the fruit will never go bad, and the leaves will actually be for the healing of the people. Fruit that is healing for the people. Because God isn't content to just bring two sticks together. His bigger plan is oneness and ultimate healing for all of God's people. Because our God is a gathering God. That's what we hear God himself say in Ezekiel 37, verse 21. I'll take them from where they've gone, I will gather them, and I'll bring them home. Because God has a way of making new things out of dried up twigs and broken branches. Anybody this morning feel like a dried up twig or a broken branch? Anybody here feel like now or at some point life just has stuck it to you? Have you drawn the short stick? Turns out, all of us just end up holding a twig, right? That's all we got. But the Spirit of God, the Spirit, he specializes in trees that flourish. He specializes in giving life and fruit, even where we feel fruitless. Because behind all of that is the promise of a day, a promise of a day when everything will be healed, as Ezekiel 37 tells us, when there will be one king. This one king will be our one true shepherd. Now, he's pointing back to the king David. David, the name David appears about 1,000 times in the Bible, but only around 60 of those are in the New Testament. And one of the first times we see the name of David in the New Testament is in Matthew chapter 12, verse 23. And in this story, Jesus encounters a demon-possessed man, and this man is not able to see, he's not able to speak, and Jesus heals this man. He sets him free. The crowds are amazed, and they wonder out loud, could this be the son of David? Could this be the one that Ezekiel and so many others were looking forward to? Could this be the one who finally brings us together, who finally brings not just healing physically, but healing for us as a people? Could it be? But if you know the story, you know that not everybody was asking that question. The Pharisees were asking a different kind of question. Could he be casting out demons by demons? To which Jesus replies, do you really think Satan is opposing Satan? Is that really the answer you want to stick with? Jesus tells them, in fact, if it's the Spirit, then the kingdom of God has come upon you. And the one kingdom that David prophesied is now here among us. In the same kingdom that Ezekiel promised. It's here in Jesus, the promised and true Son of David. Now, if this were a sermon on Matthew chapter 12, which it is not, if it was, though, I'd point you to verse 30 of Matthew 12, where it says, or Jesus says, whoever is not with me is against me, and whoever does not gather with me scatters. Somewhere I heard that word gather somewhere else in today's message from the real passage I'm using. And if this continued to be a sermon on Matthew 12, which I keep telling you it's not, so you're going to have to believe me, but Matthew 12, 33, you should hear this word too. Make a tree good, Jesus says, and its fruit will be good, or make a tree bad and its fruit will be bad, for a tree is recognized by its fruit. Something about a tree that God has planned. And Jesus is making sure the Pharisees know, if you ignore him, you ignore the kingdom that God is bringing. Make sure, he says, I think Jesus would say the same thing to us. Make sure you don't miss the kingdom work that God is doing. The very next time in Matthew we see someone call him the son of David is in chapter 15, verse 22. And it is a Canaanite woman. A Canaanite woman. You know, the kind of people who were in the land before the Israelites got there, the Hebrew people showed up, the kind of people who were dispossessed. She's there. So it's a very clear marker that something's going on here when a Canaanite woman is still there, and she's the one who recognizes Jesus as the son of David. She's the one Jesus acknowledges her faith, and then her daughter gets healed. And how can we not look back to Ezekiel and remember the tree that would bring fruit and healing for the nations? It's what God has been promising, and here we see it in Jesus, the true son of David, and he's bringing healing to, of all things, a Canaanite woman and her daughter. That's just like God, isn't it? He does surprising things when he brings sticks together. So back in Ezekiel chapter 37, in verse 23, God promises to save and cleanse us from the idols that defile us and the sins we commit. Now, of course, we can look back at that day and we can be like, man, we are so sophisticated. We would never shape an image of bronze. We would never carve something out of wood and bow down before it. Right? We wouldn't. We just wouldn't do that. We are way smarter than they are. Except we have idols that we don't physically put on tables or pedestals, right? We have idols with some of the same names. Let me just give you a few of our idols. You can fill in the blanks and you can do a mental checklist of how many of these are ones you're tempted to bow before. The gods of success, money, pleasure, popularity, comfort, power. Do we see those gods anywhere in our world today? Surely I'm not the only one who's tempted by those. But a pretty good way to gauge whether those idols have a hold on you is to look at how you're living. Because here's the thing, you can tell what you worship by how you live. How you live is a reflection of who or what you worship. For what you bow down to, you become like. What you worship, you imitate. And what you think you are pursuing to possess ends up pursuing you and possessing you. But Ezekiel 37 promises that God is the defeater of idols. He's the one that washes us clean. It doesn't matter how many you've bowed down to or how long. It doesn't matter how fully you've given yourself to the gods of this world. Our God is the one who makes things new. Because the idols of this world, they just turn us into lifeless sticks. But our God turns us into a flourishing and healed tree of life. When God has done this, when God does the work only God can do, only his hand can do, then we read in Ezekiel 37, they will be my people, and I will be their God. When we turn away from the pursuits of this world that pull and entice us, we turn to find a God who has always been pursuing us and inviting us into his perfect and healing presence. So here's the cool thing. In David, we get a shepherd boy who becomes a king. But I think in Jesus, what we get is a king who chooses to be a shepherd. It's like he goes the reverse way down the ladder, right? Because he chooses to step into your muck and mire. He chooses to step into the sheepfold that you and I are in with all our stuff and our mud and our yuck and our junk, and he gets right down in there with us. What kind of king chooses to go into the sheepfold with the messy sheep? Well, in Matthew 9:36, we see Jesus sees the crowds. He has compassion on them because they are harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. That's what Matthew says. But of course, this is not a sermon about Matthew, so let me point you to the Gospel of John and listen to what Jesus says there in John 10, verse 11. I'm the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. I wonder if old Zeke could have seen that. He saw one shepherd coming, but I wonder if even Ezekiel, the prophet, could have known that this shepherd would actually lay down his life. That's how he would bring the two together, by laying down his life. But I'll bet Ezekiel saw verse 16 coming. Look at John 10, 16. I have other sheep that are not of this sheep pen. I must bring them also. They too will listen to my voice, and there will be one flock and one shepherd. The Son of David, the true King, is also the good shepherd who goes looking for the sheep who don't seem to have any right or ability to walk through that gate into his sheepfold. He goes, he leads them, he leads us as he opens the gate and welcomes us in, making one flock. That tells me that we honor God. In fact, we are who God intends us to be when we actually are intentional about being one flock. When we choose to be one in Jesus despite our differences. So here's a question you can ask yourself. Maybe two questions. Do I primarily stay with the sheep that I'm comfortable with? With the people here, the sheep that are, I guess you could call this a sheepfold, right? We're kind of all held together. There's a few doors you can leave. You know, I prefer you not to leave while I'm preaching, but I guess you can. But since you chose to be here on a holiday weekend, think about the fact that who do you choose to be with when you're in this room and certainly when you're beyond this room? Is it just the sheep who tend to smell in the same funny ways that you smell? Who tend to wander off in the same directions that you wander off? Or do you go and connect with sheep who might be different from you but are in the same sheepfold? Here's some practical questions to help you think about it. If you're older here, you define older. If you're older, do you intentionally have a relationship with someone who's younger? And if so, do you look for them on Sundays and beyond Sundays? Do you listen to them well? Do you learn from them what really matters to them? Because there's a good chance that what matters to them overlaps with you, but doesn't. The way they see life is probably different. If you're older, are you learning from someone who's younger? And if you're younger, do you have a church grandma or grandpa? Because I hope you have tons of great, real grandparents in your life, but man, every kid, whatever your age, needs a grandma or grandpa at church. In fact, I'm sure Rachel would be glad to have that be formalized for you at 10 or 11 o'clock back in the groups that they have for kids on Sunday. Just thought of that myself. We didn't work on that together. Just kind of came out. Do what you want with it. If you're one of the folks, or if you're half of the folks in this church who have been here 20 years or longer, if you're in that 50% that we learned from our church health assessment, are you intentional about connecting with and including those who have been here less than 20 years? Less than 10? Less than 2 years? Less than 2 months? If you're married, do you see and include and welcome those who are single? If you're in the 70% or so of us who have a bachelor's degree, are you learning from someone who's never set foot on a college campus, except maybe to attend an event they had a ticket for? To be one flock, we've got to choose not to huddle with the same sheep in our own little corner of the pen. We've got to not simply talk about unity and call it a value. We've got to build it. And this kind of approach, not only does it mean that we build in, but it also means that we build out. Throughout the Old Testament, and we could do a whole message on this, a whole series of messages on the kinds of ways we see God's heart for the people that are outside the sheepfold of Israel, right? You could probably fill in your blank, your thoughts on that, but let me just give you a couple. There's Rahab, the Canaanite prostitute, who gets included in Jericho. Even as the people are coming in, she gets to stay in. How about Ruth, one of my favorites? Ruth, who's a Moabite woman, and she gets included and gets lifted up. In fact, she gets to be a part of the lineage of David, the great-grandmother, we're told, which means she's a part of the line of Jesus. How cool is that, right? Most of you have read the book of Ruth. If you haven't, you need to go home and read it this week. It's like 4 pages. It'll take you 10, 15 minutes. It's the gospel in a nutshell. It's such a cool story. We named one of our kids after it, or her. Thankfully, we named one of our daughters after her, not her son. Great story. And her story is so cool that she shows up in that book that this sermon is not about, Matthew, in the first few words, in the genealogy, the stuff that we usually skip. Matthew's way of saying this Jesus is really the Son of David. He really does go back. In fact, here's Ruth, one of the few women that shows up in Jesus' genealogy. Did I say she was a Moabite outside the sheepfold? Then how about the story that we get, or really the prophecy that we get from Isaiah? I want you to hear these words. Many of you have heard them before. They are so powerful in Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 56, 3 through 5. Listen to what he says. Let these words soak in. Let no foreigner who is bound to the Lord say, the Lord will surely exclude me from his people. And let no eunuch complain, I am only a dry tree. For this is what the Lord says, to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths, who choose what pleases me and hold fast to my covenant, to them I will give within my temple and its walls a memorial and a name better than sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that will endure forever. I don't think you can top that, right? An everlasting name that will endure forever. And it goes to foreigners and eunuchs who had been excluded. Let's jump back into verse 6. And foreigners who bind themselves to the Lord to minister to him, to love the name of the Lord, and to be his servants, all who keep the Sabbath without desecrating it, and who hold fast to my covenant, then these I will bring to my holy mountain and give them joy in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and sacrifices will be accepted on my altar, for my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations, all peoples. The sovereign Lord declares, he who gathers the exiles of Israel, I will gather still others to them besides those already gathered. I think you can see what God's up to here, right? He is a gathering God, but it's so much more than just returning 10,000 or 20 or 50,000 exiles back into a physical place. It's about including prostitutes and pagans, the outsiders and the overlooked. It's about the worn out and washed up, the down and out and the just dried up. God is making room for them. God is making room for us. And what they are welcome to, I think, actually would have been a pretty big surprise to old Zeke. Because as it turns out, the return to the land, even though it'll happen in part, the people will come back after 60 years or so in exile. They'll build a temple. They'll have somewhat of a taste of what they used to have, but it'll never be what it was under David until the son of David comes. And he's the one that returns to Zion. He returns to the place where God had promised. Matthew 21, back in Matthew, verses 12 and 13. Jesus entered the temple courts and drove out all who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves. It is written, he said to them, my house will be called a house of prayer, but you're making a den of robbers. Now, we can get caught up in the selling of stuff, and there's that going on, but it's because the temple as a whole has just been misused. It's been mistreated. It's not become what God has intended to become. And so even though the exiles have come back, and they've built this kind of temple, and then Herod added to it, and you've got this impressive structure, God's not impressed because they're not using it for the purposes of God. And so the temple then becomes a place of pulling people away from God, keeping them from God and not leading them to God. So Jesus, he comes back as if he's returning from the exile of the people. He takes on their exile and separation. He comes into the temple and he says something new and better and more amazing is coming. It's where this place will really be. Or from this place will really come a house of prayer for all nations. He's clearly pointing back to Isaiah and eunuchs and foreigners and a return. He's clearly hinting at what Ezekiel has promised, that God will unite his people, that all people will come together as one. When Ezekiel holds up those two sticks, Jesus is now saying, I will hold them together. And of course, he will hold them together by stretching out his arms, by separating his arms on the cross for us. So the return to the land and the temple turns out to actually be Jesus coming into the temple and then sending us out to be the temple. You've heard this before if you've been in church any length of time, but three times Paul, in his letters to the Corinthians, calls us the temple of God. Let me just quote one. For 2 Corinthians 6:16. For we are the temple of the living God. As God has said, I will live with them and walk among them. I will be their God and they will be my people. I love how scripture brings it all together. So here's this idea of the temple. Paul says we are the temple, which means there's no physical place we go to. As much as we love coming here and as much as this is important, you are more the temple when you leave today and you go and you be the temple where you work, in your family, in your life, in your neighborhood, in the things that you're a part of. And so the promise of Ezekiel that he will be with us is not just here, it's actually as we go and be the temple and take the Spirit of God with us. Because with God, a stick is not just a stick. It's a pointer to a church. In this case, the church in Corinth. A bunch of people who never probably got anywhere near Jerusalem or the temple. I mean, I think it's hard for us to fully appreciate how crazy it is for Paul to tell a bunch of pig-eating Gentile pagans that they're the temple of God. Like, how does that happen? It happens in the hand of God when he includes them and he brings them into this living tree that God has planted in the person of Jesus. Which means that whether you're in Corinth or Crestwood or Chickasaw or Clifton or wherever you live, you are a part of the family tree of God when you come and surrender your life to Jesus. You become a part of us and we get to live out that unity. Folks, the church is us. That's together, held together by Jesus and his Spirit. So we will not move forward because of whoever stands up here. We will move forward because together we recognize we are the church and we are called to live it out, not just on Sunday morning at 11. In fact, it's probably more important that we go live out on Monday at 9 and Friday night at 8 and all the rest of the times that we go and we live as the people of God right where we are. We are the church built up together as we build out with the good news of Jesus. So one more passage, not from Matthew this time, but from the very last page of the Bible. As if to sum it all up, the last chapter of the Bible, we hear these words in Revelation 22, 1 and 2. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city. On each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month, and the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. The prophet John sees what the prophet Ezekiel saw. He sees a similar vision of a tree that brings healing. And so what that means is, if you are in Jesus, you have the healing and the unity that he alone gives. But we know it's not perfect, right? We know it's not complete in this life. We are still broken, messy sheep. But we also know that we are living that out now, and that one day, we will gather around the throne of God and the Lamb, and we will eat of the tree of life forever. Its leaves will never go dry. Its fruit will never go bad. We will simply be able to be healed and united perfectly forever. So that's a reminder, an encouragement. We have that to look forward to. We know where we've come from. We know where we're going, so we get to live it now. So I would just close by encouraging you to hold on. Hold on to truth, hold on to each other, and hold on to Jesus, because he's the one that holds us. He's the one that holds us together. He's the one that holds us forever.